Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, episode 2481, with our old friend Gene Epstein, who is currently the director of the Soho Forum, the greatest thing on earth, a wonderful debate series in New York City, covering issues of interest to libertarians, but really of interest to people of goodwill everywhere. And I, by the time this episode has aired, will have debated someone at the Soho Forum, Brent Orell of the American Enterprise Institute, on the subject of government COVID policy. So this episode is coming out the evening of April 24th, 2024, but that's the day after the debate, so I don't know how I did. But Gene, I mean, do you have any predictions? No, you better not. You're the moderator.
Well, again, Oxford-style voting is unforgiving. The fact is that the more fans you have in the audience who like or on your side, the worse it is for you, as you know, because you have to move the needle. So literally true that our mutual friend Bob Murphy did a debate at Freedom Fest, and 100% of the people voted for him initially. This is literally what happened. And so he says, I have nowhere to hope it down. So if you get 100% of the vote, it's going to be hopeless for you, Tom.
Yeah, right. And meanwhile, Gene, you're urging me, share this with your audience, which I have been. But the more I do it, the worse it is for me.
But all of a sudden, look, I throw a Tootsie Roll at the winner. The Oxford style voting is just a game. It gives a little drama to the evening.
Right.
The fact is, as I keep repeating, we are individualists. The question is, what did you personally think? The truth is not put to a democratic vote.
The
truth is what you think, and that's what will be most important. So don't let it faze you.
Right, and to me, the key thing is that I will have recorded out there somewhere my basic, 17 and a half minute gist of the whole thing, because we each get 17 and a half minute opening statements. And I will be going until 17 minutes, 30 seconds, Gene, you can be absolutely sure of that.
Well, that's good. Yeah, and indeed, that's what distinguishes us all from people protest that I let people deliver speeches, so 17 and a half minutes. I point out, that's not even that long for a speech. It is somewhat unorthodox. Most debate societies don't do that. I'm going to go easy on the banter this time, Tom, because you gave me such a huge assignment. I only want to thank you for that 16-page newsletter that you sent out. Receiving it in the mail was a real pleasure. I think you're basically doing it for types like me, fans like me, who are going to turn 80 this November. Brings back memories when I used to get Eye of Stones weekly in the mail. Eye of Stone was a famous left-wing journalist, usually critical of American foreign policy.
Yep.
And so it brought me back. It was nostalgic. It was 16 meaty pages to read. So I want to thank you for that. And I want to commend you on your mid-course correction in terms of your own career. Where are you going to go from here now that you've won that cockamamie award in Vienna? And what you're really doing is you're shifting gears. You're keeping your Tom Woods show live. Three times a week is still an enormous burden to get in the guest on.
Yes, it is.
You're doing the School of Life. I think you're headed in the right direction. I think you know what you're doing. You've had a great time in your first half century. I think your second half century will be even better. I gather you turn 52 years old this August 1st. So the first year of your second half century, I think, has done very well. And I commend you on that greatly. As a matter of fact, one of my principal benefactors, overwhelmingly important benefactor, I want to give a shout out to him, Jeremy Wood, is a huge fan of yours. And I gather he plans to come to your Florida event, which I think you're going to have, June 20th. 21st.
June 21st to 22nd. TomWoods.com/unconference.
Shows up. Please treat him with all due respect.
Absolutely will. Any friend of the Soho Forum is a friend of mine.
That would be great. Okay, now I want to, and of course I want to also thank the tough love that I received from my friend Jeff Deist and my friend Tom Woods. They decided they would have a show in which they would mention my name maybe 11 or 12 times.
All right, well, Gene, let me intervene here. You're talking, I intervene. Okay, first of all, everybody knows that with episodes with Gene Epstein, we banter at the beginning.
No banter!
Well, hold on, that is banter. We just had that was banter.
Okay,
let me just explain, everybody.
Yeah.
I understand, having been podcasting for over 10 years, that this violates every rule of podcast. Like, you've got to get into the show in the first minute or you're going to lose the... With episodes with Gene, I don't care if I lose those people, right? Those people weren't going to benefit from an episode with Gene Epstein anyway. I want the people who've been around for a while, who understand who Gene is, he's a great guy, that it enriches your soul to hear him talk about things and be enthusiastic. It spreads to you his enthusiasm. So I want to have a few minutes of banter. The damn rules of podcasting be damned, okay? So let's say that. Second thing, well, the thing that Gene cryptically referred to before is that, yeah, I send an email newsletter and it's great and you should all join it. You can join it at tomsfreebooks.com. Get a free book while you're at it. But I also send out a print newsletter because no one else does that. It's old school. Nobody else does that. That's why I'm doing it. And the print newsletter is much hotter than the email newsletter. Yeah. And you get it at supportinglisteners.com. So Gene has just outed himself as one of the most embarrassing things he could possibly be, a supporter of the Tom Woods Show. So you get that newsletter at supportinglisteners.com. It's mailed to you in the mail every month. You know, and these days, Gene, since everything's online, the only thing you get in the mail now is like ads and bills, and it's depressed. There's no fun at the mailbox anymore. Now there's fun at the mailbox. So supportinglisteners.com.
I also jump. I mean, I've given it the usual kiss of death by saying that maybe you have to be pushing 80 years old to appreciate it.
Yeah, and it's for all ages, people, well, all ages.
I just don't know, Tom.
Especially you young people, if you read the newsletter, you can get a flavor of what life was like in the 1980s. Exactly. We read printed newsletters that were mailed to us.
Maybe even the 69-year-olds will appreciate it, Tom. And I certainly hope so. I only want to say that I'm sure it's enough for you simply to know that I appreciate it. If the rest hate it, doesn't matter. Just so long as it gets appreciation from me.
I am amusing Gene Epstein, which is indeed very much a reward in its own right. So what we wanted to do today, as Gene was about to say before I interrupted him, is revisit an episode I had not all that long ago with our old friend Jeff Deist, who was saying some things about the economy and the cost of living and stuff like that, especially for younger people. And Gene's name was mentioned a number of times. And since Gene is a very, very faithful listener of the Tom Woods Show, I always know if I mention Gene's name, I'm going to hear something about it. And hear something about it, I did. So Gene wants to talk a little bit about that. And then I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Gene's own recent debate.
Oh, yeah.
If we have the time for that.
Well, John, that's the reason why we probably want to, the last time the banter went for 20 minutes, although there was a lot of substance in having to do with your book. So that's why. There's so much to cover.
All right, so let's see. So Gene, what is the thing that was most offensive to you?
Okay. All right, I will answer that question, Tom.
All right.
But I just want to say, before I answer that question, that what I was going, as a matter of fact, I'm going to do my clever routine and turn it around and say that, in a way, perhaps, what was most effective, the most offensive, is that you guys didn't even realize some of the most disturbing things happening in the U.S. economy that are really affecting the culture that Jeff Deist spoke about. And of course, I thought it was a little bit funny that Jeff Deist was encouraging economists to write, to broaden their perspective and to write about culture. I would have added, please recommend that Paul Krugman avoid those issues and that so many others who don't know much about economics avoid those issues. But in a way, what you guys missed is the real undercurrent of what's been happening. And I want to mention a couple of things.
Please do.
What did you miss? Well, in the book that is called The Myth of American Inequality, it was co-authored by a guy named John Early, who actually has government credentials. He was formerly with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And he very good at digging up the data better than I am. And in fact, I've corresponded with him. And he dug up a stunning statistic about what has happened to the poorest one-fifth of the population with respect to whether they have a job or not. And I asked him, by the way, in the book, I didn't find sufficient backing for the data. So I emailed him to get a complete litany of how he dug this up. In 1967, two-thirds of the poorest one-fifth eligible to work, we could get into the definition, but trust him, had jobs. Two-thirds had jobs in 1967. In 2017, when the labor market was just as tight, basically just as tight, that had collapsed to one third. And of the poorest 20% had jobs. And again, it was a tight labor market. So the only thing that you can really trace as a causal variable was the quadrupling in constant dollars of government transfer payments. And so if you and Jeff are talking about what's going on in the world, you have a situation in which we all basically understand that the ticket out of poverty is having a job, starting on one rung of the ladder and maybe rising to another. If it's now that two-thirds of the poorest one-fifth don't even have a job when the labor market was tight, and it used to be one-third, two-thirds don't, and it used to be that one-third don't, that's deeply disturbing. And people like Charles Murray have written about it, and they almost say that they don't know what can be done about it. And what it really means is that government policies in aiding the poor basically bit to perpetuate, to trap them in poverty. Part of the reason why, of course, is the understandable fiscal cliff that we refer to, which still exists, where if you're receiving certain government payouts, you start losing almost dollar for dollar if you get a job. And certainly that's, you can't quite blame people like that, but we've created a culture of poverty. And I think that to talk about problems of American society and to leave that out is to leave out something that's absolutely vital. And I want to add to that another statistic that I've been harping on. And the person who's written a lot about this, although I was working on it before he came out with the book, is Nick Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute in his book, Men Without Work. And he takes the prime age men, 25 to 54, which the Bureau of Labor Statistics publishes all the time, every month, how many of them are actually either looking for work or have a job? How many of them are participating in the labor force? What share is participating in the labor force? Well, in 1964, it was 96.9%. Again, these are 25 to 54-year-olds. Most of them have finished college. Most of them, many of them at least, are now alumni of professional school. By 1990, this had declined to 93.6%, from 96.9 to 93.6. Let's even imagine that 93.6 is an okay number because maybe more of them are in medical school and in graduate school. But by 2024, it had declined to 89.2%. And as Nick Eberstadt shows through surveys, these men are not house husbands. They're not taking care of anyone. And you can do a simple calculation and ask the following. If instead of 89.2% of prime age men in the labor force, it were still at 93.6%, as it was in 1990, there would be 2.8 million more men in the labor force. Now, when Jeff Dice talked about how old people aren't getting married, they aren't starting families, I'm trying to point out that this problem, this absolute constant drop in the share of prime age men in the labor force started in the mid-1960s and has persisted. The 89.2% as of 2024 is below the highs of 2019. So I'm saying that what you guys missed in terms of talking about marriage, in terms of talking about how people are suffering or have the potential to climb out of poverty, I think you missed those key statistics, which, and I have to give all due credit to conservatives like Charles Murray and to Nick Eberstadt bringing our attention to those numbers. So that's what I was going to start with. And of course, I wanted to start with that in order to point out that it's not as though I'm a Pollyanna compared to you guys. I see something deeply disturbing in these numbers, and what you can do about them is a real question. It's truly a problem. And at least it blasts away the idea that government is in the business of trying to alleviate poverty. It's really in the business of trying to perpetuate poverty. I had that advance when for 7 months in my early career, I worked for the welfare department in New York City, otherwise known as the Human Resources Administration. Any comment on that?
Well, I appreciate this. I know that is it Eberstadt, the last name?
Mick Eberstadt, yeah.
I found out about his work because I think he actually presented on it at the Mises Institute.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, he has a talk there. And I thought, well, that's a nice crossover because there isn't a lot of interaction, I think, with the Mises Institute and AI.
Men without work, yes.
Yeah.
Well, actually, John Early's numbers, I've been telling John that 2017 is his most recent number, that he's got to get the data together to update it for 2022. But the two-thirds, one-third of the poorest, 20%, have a job. Two-thirds don't. They're not even working. And it used to be two-thirds. So that, in a way, I think, is the most stunning number. And it took a lot of work on the part of John Early to dig it up from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So in a way, I think that's the least known and the most stunning number of all. And again, if you've created this culture of poverty where your parents didn't work, your grandparents didn't work, there's no culture of work that is in your inheritance, in your environment. And that is deeply disturbing, more disturbing than anything you and Jeff mentioned when you were spending a lot of time correcting me for my mistakes. I wanted to mention one other thing that you said that actually missed the boat, which was kind of interesting.
I refuse to believe this. Let's hear it.
I said it was kind of, I wanted a job. Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm going to do that one later. All right. Yeah. No, yeah. You spoke about how the bubble economy, the way you put it was that we get a lot of bad eggs. We get a lot of incompetent people in line because if you're choosing upsides, you're including these people in, they get their chance to participate and bad results happen from that. The worst people get involved. I felt that you were understating the issue in a serious way. It's really an echo of Friedrich Hayek's line, the worst get on top. Because what really happens, especially the housing bubble was a perfect example, is that the conservatives, the sober-minded, who know that capitalism is a system of profit and loss, they get shunted aside because they're not bringing in the big bucks. The crab shooters actually get on top. So you see how you were understating the problem. My primary example of that goes back to the housing bubble, which, of course, I was writing about and I lived through. Angelo Mozilla, who recently died of Countrywide, he knew nothing about mortgages, but he was the major shaker and mover with respect to those subprime mortgages. He was celebrated at Harvard in February 2003, and he delivered a talk in which he bragged about the fact that 80% of his customers, of the subprime borrowers, were paying their mortgages on time. And the Harvard people cheered him. And this is the perfect example of the guy who gets on top. And of course, it was pointed out, not just by me, but by others, that if you get a 20% delinquency rate on payments, then you're not charging enough. You don't have enough to cover your losses. 20% delinquency rate is way too high. The sober mortgage issuers live with a 1% delinquency rate, not a 20%. And he's cheered at Harvard. My point is that it's worse than you said. It's that the crab shooters say, hey, look at all the big bucks we could be making. This guy with a starchy collar who's conservative, what do you need him for? Kick him out. I've got to run the show. And that was Angelo Mozilla. He was king of the hill, a guy who knew nothing about mortgages. All he knew was about politics. So that's my point. In other words, you are way understating the problem when you spoke about the bubble economy. It's not just the worst get in line, it's the worst get on top. So I wanted to make that point as well. I don't know if you have anything you wanted to mention about that.
Hey folks, it's Old Woods here, and I am doing what I do best, and that is making your life better. And here's how I'm doing it this time. We are faced in our day and age with information overload like never before. There is a huge wave of content that hits us every single day, taking all different kinds of forms, and more books being published than ever before, and it's hard to know what's worth your time and what isn't. Well, with the Blinkist app, you can absorb huge amounts of information and get just the golden nuggets you need in 27 nonfiction categories: history, philosophy, parenting, career, technology, religion. And Blinkist condenses each book into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to. So that means if you have a half-hour commute each way, you can absorb the equivalent of 4 books a day. Imagine what an impressive person you'll be after that. And among the thousands and thousands of titles at Blinkist, you'll find even libertarian classics that you probably wouldn't find in a lot of other platforms, like Murray Rothbard, Milton Friedman, and even a book by old Tom Woods here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 40% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods, to get 40% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium subscription. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. Well, especially given all the things we want to talk about, I actually want to just ask you 2 things that I'd like to know the answer to.
Oh, wow.
One of them I mentioned in the email. And the other one, well, let's start with the other one first.
Okay.
This one I didn't warn you about, but I'm sure you've seen that a lot of people are saying people just don't, for some reason, understand how good the economy is right now. You've seen this, right? That actually they think they're doing badly, but look at the numbers. They're not doing badly. Joe Biden is just very unfortunate in that he's presiding over a robust economy, but people are too dumb to perceive it. What's your response to that?
Okay, well, 2 things. Number one, I respect the 2 longest running surveys of consumer confidence and sentiment from the University of Michigan and from the Conference Board. They both go back to the 1970s, and so we can make decent comparisons. And what it shows is that we are still below the highs of 2021. I'm losing track of my numbers here. 2019. Yeah, what boy, I'm getting drawing a blank. The lockdown started in March of 2020. So 2019 was the last high, correct me if I'm wrong. The confidence and the sentiment numbers are still mediocre. They're not bad. It's not as though, in terms of confidence and sentiment from both of these surveys, the people are saying that we're in recession territory or in the dumps. It is true, though, that in both cases, they are saying that it was better the year before the lockdowns. The economy was doing better. They had more and higher confidence. So I don't know if I've corrected you there. I think we have published all the time short surveys that have very little history to them and not nearly as well designed as the August and robust Conference Board and University of Michigan confidence indexes, which I think are less reliable. So I'm going halfway to your point. I am saying that people are still say that under Trump, the year before the lockdown, things were better than they are today. Are you looking a little puzzled?
No, not at all.
Okay, all right. So therefore, but what I would say is that, and something else that's interesting, is that Paul Krugman keeps arguing that it's only the Republicans, people who want to vote Republican, who are weighting the numbers against Biden. It's only their own, that it splits along party lines. I said, well, and my point, well, if it splits along party lines, it looks as though that since the numbers show that these 2 robust surveys are saying that under Trump, prior to the lockdowns, we were doing better. And I guess Trump's going to win the election. The Republicans are dominating if he's right. So therefore, they are indeed saying things are simply not nearly as good as they were in 2019 under Trump. Now, I think that the principal reason why people are depressed, people are not as enthusiastic, is because of the shock of inflation. And Now, the one thing, of course, you and I should remind people about inflation is that when the newspapers say, well, we were down, we were at 2.5% over the last 12 months. Well, that's not the way people live. In people's lived experience over the previous 5 years, prices, according to the Consumer Price Index, were up 22.8%. In other words, that prices rose last year, and now they're rising again. And what do you think the average consumer is going to do? Say, oh, wow, it's just up by 2.5%. Well, people live through a few years worth of price hikes, and they are hurting from that price inflation of 22.8%. But most importantly, The University of Michigan asked people about their inflation expectations. And the expectation is that inflation will be 3% for the next 5 years on the part of the University of Michigan consumer expectation. Now, that's another 16% compounded on top of the 22% punishment that people have experienced. And so what I'm really saying is that the reason why people are giving this economy a low rating is that until 2019, they were used to inflation, but nothing nearly as bad as what we've had. So they've had this shock, and they don't, obviously do not think that the Federal Reserve is going to meet its 2% target. They think it's going to be 3% per year, and 3% a year on top of all the punishment they have received, and they don't like that. So therefore, what I'm doing is splitting the difference and saying, nobody's saying things are terrible. The Michigan and Commerce Board indexes are not at recession levels. They're higher than, they're pretty much at expansion levels. But the reason why they're still rating it low is that they are shocked by the inflation, and they do believe that the inflation is going to persist and the punishment is going to persist. And that's clearly something that gets them a bit depressed, understandably. So that's my full explanation. And do you have any comment about that?
Okay, well, that's fair enough. I mean, so that's the one thing that I've heard quite a bit.
But I want to jump in and say that according to, and now this is where Jeff is, again, and possibly you are going to disagree with me, according to numbers that from our whole range of different snapshots, wages and salaries on all levels have kept somewhat ahead of inflation. It's not as though people are doing worse. That goes, there are different snapshots of wages. I, unlike Jeff, respect the consumer price index. Unlike Jeff, I actually think it somewhat overstates price inflation, reasons I can go into. So therefore, I do not think that people are doing worse, but I do think that they're giving a relatively low rating, but not abysmally low to the economy because of the inflation shock and their lack of confidence in the government's ability to tame inflation. And certainly their lack of confidence in the government's ability to tame inflation is got a lot of justification
right.
to it. So
yeah.
That's what I would ask. Yeah.
Well, now, also on the inflation front, sometimes when you try to explain to people that rising prices are not a natural phenomenon, that they don't just happen. They're not happening because of greed. They're not happening because of all these external reasons. Yeah. But they're happening because of policy. They're happening because of central bank policy.
Yeah. Well,
then sometimes you get, or even if you don't mention the central bank, most people who are unhappy in this way don't know anything about the central bank. What they'll say is, look at these record high profits that corporations are having.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
We're all suffering, and they're raking in record high profits. That goes to show this is all a plan. Like, they're doing this on purpose. They make more profits when they raise the prices on us.
Yeah, okay. Well, all right, then let me answer the question about profits as you raised it. I keep posting the Bureau of Economic Analysis numbers on the profit margins of non-financial corporations going back to the late 1940s. Now, the reason why I do, and the non-financial corporations still account for about 85% of all of the corporate sector. Back in the late 1940s, they accounted for over 90%. So I'm leaving out the financial firms. You might challenge me on that. Financial firms are a bit different, so they're about 15%. But I believe that the best continuous measure would be the non-financial corporations, which includes all the software companies. It just doesn't include the hedge funds and the banks that are incorporated and that are a much more important part of the economy than they used to be. I would defend that, go with that for a moment. I look at profit margins properly measured as a share of income as defined and measured by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. And I find that profit margins today are comparable to where they were in the 1950s and 60s. That means they're somewhat high. We have a very weird pattern, an interesting pattern, and there are lots of lessons in this. The profit margins were relatively high in the 50s and 60s, and over the past few years, they've been comparable, the same profit margins for the non-financial corporations. And Then when the inflation hit in the 70s and early 80s, profit margins fell. And that's because, obviously, inflation is a two-edged sword for corporations. You're charging higher prices, but what's happening to your costs? Because your costs are also prices. And so, in fact, the inflation periods of the 1970s and 80s were bad for profit margins for the corporations. So, ironically, in the relatively low inflation period of the 1950s and 60s, we had relatively high profit margins, and now we have a return to those same profit margins. Now, I believe at least then, I should mention, the only reason why people like Robert Reich and others report record profits going back to 70 years is that they use after-tax profits. They use after-tax profits, not pre-tax profits. Now, why should you use pre-tax profits? Because pre-tax profits are a continuous comparable variable. They don't introduce the fact that corporate profit tax rates have declined. Now, I need to add something else to that. Even though corporate tax rates have declined, when you think about it, and then when you look at data, the fact is that while the corporation itself may be paying less in terms of a share of its declared profits to the government, a lot of that money is captured in interest they pay on their bonds, in dividend payouts that they make, in salaries that they pay some of their higher employees. And so the fact is that to say that you want to tell the story about profit margins, when all that story amounts to is that the headline on the corporate profits is lower than it used to be, I think is misleading. Pre-tax profits shows a consistent trend. I'm giving you a whole mouthful. I have something else to add, but maybe I want to pause at the moment. I'm saying that based upon pre-tax profits, corporations are doing no better than they did in the 1950s and 60s during a period of low inflation.
Okay, so you could say that to them, and you'd be right.
Yeah.
But then there's still this feeling on the part of some people. They really want to think that corporations are sticking it to them and that that's what's happening here. So,
well, we have to get back to the old idea that greed is not a new phenomenon.
Can I give you a specific example?
God, yes.
No. All right, here's a specific example. We've heard that in a number of marketplaces, these are outliers, no doubt, but maybe there are going to be more of them. If you go to McDonald's and you get a particular meal, it's some crazy amount that you're paying. And I feel like on some level, McDonald's does not want to have to be charging that, because then there's a certain constituency that goes to McDonald's that tends to be lower income. I mean, everybody goes to McDonald's, I suppose, but tends to be lower income. And if it gets to the point where, okay, they'll bite the bullet and just make a sandwich at home, they're just going to do that. They really don't want it. But then if you turn around and say, but look at McDonald's profits, I guess it is working out for them, then what is the right story there? I feel like McDonald's does not want to be in this position.
Well, okay. All right. Okay. Then I guess, okay. I think now we do have to segue into the basic story about the money supply. And I mean, obviously, McDonald's would like to maximize its profits. That's a working assumption. Corporations want to maximize their profits.
And parentheses, sometimes you maximize your profits by raising the price, indeed.
Yes.
But sometimes you maximize them by keeping the price the same, sometimes by lowering the price. We're always looking around for where we want to put it that will get us the highest profit.
Yes.
But it's not always by just raising the price, which I think is what the average person making this kind of argument thinks, that you just raise the price, you get more profits. Everybody would be raising the price constantly if that were the case.
Oh, of course. Okay, but let me short this out.
Okay.
Recognize again that, as I've said, McDonald's is part of those non-financial corporations. And those non-financial corporations are doing about as well as they did in the 1950s and 1960s when inflation was relatively tame in terms of their profit margins. They are doing better, in other words, than they did in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. By the way, I should add, come to think of it, that if you actually calculate the degree to which they are doing better, take those dollars, those extra dollars that they're making compared to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and then you try to account for consumer price inflation, then the numbers don't add up. I don't know if you know. In other words, you've got $11, $12 trillion worth of consumer spending, and those extra profits don't really match up. You know, anyway, but if you follow what I'm just saying, but my only point is that McDonald's has chosen those prices. Ironically, as a matter of fact, you know, Dave Smith talked about how he had to pay $17 for a hamburger and fries and Coke. And I was on Ro Bernstein's show, and I said, I pass McDonald's every day on my way to work, and they're charging $10. I said, Dave is getting a little bit carried away with that $17. McDonald's is charging $10 for the Coke and the Big Mac. So, all right, I guess that $10 is high. But McDonald's is choosing the $10. It wants to maximize profits. So I'm not glad. They could choose to pay nine, to charge nine or eight. They are choosing the $10 because they feel that's their best judgment is that that's the profit maximizing price point. I only pointed out that Dave was way over the top with what he was paying for his burger and fries, and it was implying that's ubiquitous. But that aside, that's the price point they've chosen it. Now, it seems to me that the only answer, and I don't know what it was. I didn't look. Maybe McDonald's was charging $8 a few years ago, and now it's up to $10. So maybe that is the case. But they've chosen it. But why are they able to choose it? Because of an explosion in the money supply. Because there's just a lot of money out there. And where did the explosion come from? It came from the Federal Reserve. Why did the Federal Reserve explode the money supply? Because the Federal Reserve had to finance the huge deficits that the U.S. government decided to incur during the lockdowns. This, by the way, gets back to the debate I had.
I was just going to say that in your debate, you made a point that I don't think your opponent had ever even thought of before. You explained in the debate how the Federal Reserve, in an indirect way, made the lockdowns possible. And I would love it if you would explain that.
Well, yes. Well, thank you. Yeah. The U.S. economy got locked down in March of 2020. And suddenly, revenues are suffering. And there is a need on the part of the U.S. government to shower the economy with money so that the unemployment rate soars to an 80-year high of 14.8% by April of 2020. And so unless you print money, people are going to have problems. So the U.S. Treasury incurred deficits, and as I jokingly put it, made previous deficits look stingy by comparison. In 2020, the deficit was $3.1 trillion, and by 2021, it was $2.8 trillion. It completely dwarfed previous deficits incurred in prior years. That's nearly $6 trillion worth of debt that you have to put out there. There was no way for them to go to the credit markets to borrow on that debt. The only way they could do it was to hand the debt over to the Federal Reserve to monetize it. And then you look at the Federal Reserve numbers, the Federal Reserve holdings of treasuries absolutely took off. And so how did they acquire that debt? They acquired that debt by printing money. Then you look at the next clue, the standard measure of money known as M2. M2 is cash plus checks plus near monies like savings accounts and money market funds. And we have data going back to 1960 on the M2. We find that there were two spikes in the 1970s coinciding with the hyperinflation then. And then the mother of all spikes in 2021 coinciding with the inflation that we have recently had. The money supply is now still much higher than it used to be. So that's the simple explanation. The money went out there. The amount of money in people's hands soared. And we had then a standard, by the way, Milton Friedman, Chicago school type, occasion of the money supply getting out of control. I try to explain to my audience that when the government finances its operations through an expansion of the money supply, it's a two-step process. It's a subtle two-step process. First, the Treasury prints bonds. And then the Federal Reserve prints the money to buy the bonds. It's not like the old days when governments only printed money. First, the bonds get printed. Now, I pointed out that if this money spigot were not available in the Federal Reserve, then I don't think the lockdowns would have been feasible. The Treasury would have understood that if you shut the economy down and you can't shower the economy with money, you can't incur nearly $6 trillion worth of debt, then we really can't lock the economy down. And I came up with the conjectural argument that they might have turned to the time-honored solution of focused protection put forward by Jay Bhattacharya. I recommend that people listen to that debate to follow my argument, but really their hands would have been tied. But of course they knew that this nearly $6 trillion worth of debt could be handed over to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve could print the money. And again, we saw it in classic fashion. At the M2 exploded, checks were written to people, $600 supplemental checks to people on unemployment insurance, a 14.8% unemployment rate. The last time we had that was in 1940, at the tail end of the Great Recession. So the money was still sloshing around. And when money is sloshing around and demand starts to soar, then that business responds and raises its prices accordingly. It's too much money chasing few too goods. And now this is the part that I'm not going to be able to define. In the 1970s, early 80s inflation, corporations were caught in a squeeze because prices are a two-edged sword. They're the prices you pay to run your operations and the prices you charge. The fact of the matter is that profit margins actually declined with the double-digit inflation of the 1970s, early 80s, declined from the 50s and 60s. This time around, profit margins rose. So I don't know why they got lucky. Prices rose faster than their costs rose. I could conjecture about explanation, but at least I want to say that profits are not at a record high. You have the ambiguous irony that the profits, at best, are comparable to the way the non-financial corporations were doing in the low inflation 1950s and 60s. So to get back to your question, why did McDonald's choose that price point? Because that price point seemed compatible with the explosion in the money supply, with the fact that people were getting those $600 checks in the mail to supplement their unemployment insurance. And so they saw the opportunity to raise their prices, increase their profit margins, even though, again, I insist, these are not off-the-wall profit rates. They are only comparable to what used to happen in the 1950s and 60s. Maybe I should shut up. That's pretty much the story. Did I leave anything else to confuse the issue in any way?
No. I think there's clarity here. It's just that I have so many, your answers are so long, which is not a problem because they clarify the issue. Okay. But it means that I don't have time to banter with you about them. I want to go on to the next thing. Because I want to talk about the debate for a minute.
Oh, thank you.
So you debated this guy on the subject of COVID and his particular take. This is a guy, I mean, you can introduce him to people in a minute. But his take is he's anti-lockdown. He thinks that was a terrible thing to do to ordinary people. But his complaint is that capitalism is what left us unprepared for COVID and why we didn't do as well as we might have. And then you were trying to explain all these different ways in which it was not real capitalism. It was obviously a collusion between private and public. And then he's trying to come back with, well, okay, but that's the capitalism we have now. Okay, but that's a different thing. I'm not responsible for that.
I guess, Tom, I got admonished, as I told you, from Mark Skousen, a mutual friend, when I use the word crapitalism.
But it's a good word.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yeah. Your ears don't burn at that dirty word crap. It's not crapitalism. So I said that capitalism is a system of profit and loss. Crapitalism or crony capitalism is a system in which the government steps in and protects companies against losses and enhances their profits. And so I pointed out that the vaccine story was very much a case of crapitalism, crony capitalism. And by the way, I did tell Joe Nocera, my opponent, I don't want to get into an argument about the vaccines, but if it wasn't, If capitalism weren't involved, then the vaccines would have been voluntary. That's all. They wouldn't have been mandatory. But because Tony Fauci, and as revealed to us by Rand Paul, who kept grilling them, because the NIH and Tony Fauci were getting money from the pharmaceutical companies, they were pushing hard for people to be forced to take the vaccines. And this is a funny moment when Joe Nocera said, I don't know if Tony Fauci took any money from the government, from the pharmaceutical companies, and neither do you. So I said, you know, Rand Paul kept asking, did you take money? Did you take money? And Fauci would, if Fauci didn't take money, he should have said, no, I don't. But he never said that. He was taking money. So I pointed that out. But then indeed, then I pointed out that the Federal Reserve, which is also a crony capital system, which supports the banks, was key to the lockdowns. And there, too, we had crony capitalism at work, not real capitalism. Oh, I'm sorry. And then when he said, oh, you're talking about utopianism and that capitalism, profit and loss, I said, this is the reality that most small businesses have to live with, profit and loss. Profits encourage risk-taking, and they encourage a useful allocation of resources. Losses encourage prudence and penalize a bad allocation of resources. And losses are just as important to the proper functioning of capitalism as profits are. And that indeed, of course, when you talk about, think about some of the companies, how Barnes & Noble used to dominate the book business and is now shrunken, they too know what losses are. So therefore, it's not as though I'm asking for utopia. I'm simply asking for the profit and loss system to apply across the board and not to have been abrogated by the government during the COVID period. And of course, my main point was indeed that the Federal Reserve, the major crony capital system that supports the banks, was essential to the lockdowns. I said, look, indulge me in a conjecture. If the Treasury's hands were tied, I'm not even saying abolish the Federal Reserve. I'm just saying, no, you can't use the Federal Reserve to buy your bonds. It's very clear the Treasury would have recognized our hands are tied. We can't finance lockdowns. And then, as the great Barrington people who authored Focus Protection pointed out, Focus Protection, doing it rationally, protecting those who are vulnerable and letting the rest function, was a very time-honored way of running things. Indeed, that's the way Sweden did it. That's, by and large, the way DeSantis did it in Florida. So that probably would have been the most plausible way they would have done it had the Federal Reserve not been there to print the money. Thank you for allowing me to summarize what I said in that debate. I do recommend that people listen to it because Joe Nocera was given every opportunity to respond to my arguments. And I think it was a useful debate. And of course, my main point, when somebody asked me a question about this idea that capitalism mostly about profits, I said, tragically, the mainstream textbooks don't really teach us that capitalism is fundamentally a system of profit and loss, and losses are just as important as profits to the proper functioning of capitalism. So thank you for allowing me to give that summary of what I said. And I do recommend the video and the audio, which are available on our website at thesoulforum.org.
Folks, it's Old Woods to remind you that it's springtime, a time when we're doing things for our families like spring cleaning or planning outdoor activities. But the most important thing you can do for your family this spring is to shop for life insurance using Policy Genius. Remember the safety net life insurance provides. So if something were to happen to you, your family could cover expenses while getting back on their feet. And Policy Genius will help you do that. I have tremendous peace of mind because my family is fully provided for with my life insurance policy. And it's much less expensive than you think. But move quickly because it does increase in price as you get older. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. And even if you already have life insurance through work, it may not offer enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. Well, with just a few clicks, you'll be comparing quotes from top insurers and finding your lowest price. The licensed, award-winning agents at Policy Genius can help you find the best fit for your needs. They work for you, not for the insurance companies, so they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another. No wonder they have thousands of five-star reviews at Google and Trustpilot. So save time and money and give your family a financial safety net with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. Can I ask you one more thing related to the debate?
Sure.
Just for you to elaborate on? One of the criticisms he made of capitalism is he kind of equates capitalism and globalization.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he says because of globalization and because of the integration of all these economies, that means that when push comes to shove and we have a crisis like this and we need particular goods, you know, like medical equipment, we're not producing them. We get them from some other country, and this left us unprepared.
So, yes. Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for contributing to that point. You know, as a matter of fact, I want to add something that I didn't add that evening. But what I pointed out, without getting into the weeds about that part of it, was I played a game and I said that globalization is best measured, I assume we can all accept, including Joe, the measure of imports as a share of gross domestic product. And I said, maybe the United States, it used to be in 1970, it was 5% imports as a share of gross domestic product, 5%. And by 2019, it went up to nearly 15%. So it nearly tripled. So indeed, capitalism does indeed encourage globalization, and it happened. But then I played the game and I said, here's a country with an even worse problem. It added many more points to its imports. It went from 22% up to 47%. It's like twice as much increase in globalization from 1970 to 2019. So according to Joe, it must have been really in the soup because it was so globalized. And I said, the country I just described is Sweden. Sweden, which even Joe agrees, had a laissez-faire approach, which did much better. And indeed, I said, so that hopefully alone demonstrates that you can cope even if you are very globalized. And then, in fact, I then started, this is funny, Joe said, I'll accept Gene's word on this. He said that. I said, look, it's fairly obvious. The U.S. economy is a much larger economy than Sweden's, Germany's, Norway's, or any of those other countries. Smaller economies are much more globalized than large economies like the U.S. We are one of the least globalized economies in terms of our dependence on imports from abroad. I should have added, maybe just to round up people's understanding, that don't confuse globalization with multinationals. Indeed, the U.S. has McDonald's all over China and all over Japan. It's got Walmart all over. So indeed, we've got a lot of multinational investment. And by the way, when a U.S. multinational sends goods back to the U.S., that too counts as imports. And so I was including that in the import figure. But in terms of what Joe is referring to, we are one of the least globalized economies. And Sweden did much better. So if globalization was such a problem, Sweden somehow or other found a way to deal with it. And then perhaps you remember, well, this gets to the masks, you know, but you were the one who talked to me. Sweden, I think I've written it in your book, Sweden was one of the least use of masks. I mean, if the others, they didn't have to get their N19. Matt, is that what they are? The masks that are supposed to be so wonderful. What are they called? The N19 masks? I forget.
N95, yeah.
N95s?
Yeah.
Forgot my number. Yeah, the N95. Yeah, the N95 mask. And then, you know, because Joe was saying they couldn't get the N95 mask. Oh, we should have produced them if we
yeah, and by the way, I call them suffocation masks. Or duck masks, because they make you look like a duck.
Well, I do. I'm going to avoid my little dirty thing, but I like, now I forget the name of the woman. And, you know, she talked to me, now you see those kids with their masks, and basically they're wiping their mouths and their noses with those masks. Have to wear them. You know, they don't really use them. And I said, well, they might want to wipe their, I'd like them all to end up wiping their butts with them. But anyway, that aside, the kids were not really, the use of those masks was not really, that's part of the problem with masks, I guess. But thank you for allowing me to get into that part of it, Tom, and hopefully not spoil it for folks, because I think that it was a useful exchange. And the debate that I guess that just took place between you and Brent O'Rell on the broader subject is our attempt to cover this most important issue that all of us lived through. And then just go to thesoulforum.org to see all of our debates. But on July 15th, we're going to have Matt Ridley defending the argument about the virus originating from the Wuhan lab in China. That will be Matt Ridley, whom you and I, and I think a lot of your listeners are familiar with, best-selling author. But I do have a lot of other things to cover, Tom. No, how much time we have? I wanted to then respond a little bit more to what you and Jeff Dice.
All right, I'll give you, you got 5 minutes.
Oh my God.
And we got to wrap it up. You save it for another episode. Because I do want to conclude with, I have a particular conclusion for this episode that I don't want to lose the time.
A wonderful surprise, Sean. Okay. I'm going to clear my good name, Tom. You know, I don't,
Gene, the floor is yours, but now it's 4 minutes 40.
Oh God, so. Okay. Many folks are struggling. People are always struggling. People have been struggling for years. And of course, I return to my main point that most people are doing somewhat better than they did in 2019. And I guess I'm not going to have enough time to prove that. But I do want to agree, for example, that, as you said, the younger people are having a somewhat harder time. And indeed, that's true. Oddly, I'm going to sound really callous and say, if it was a forced choice, should the middle-aged people, should the old people, or should the young people have a harder time? Then if it's a forced choice, I would say probably the young people can cope with it better than you and me, but it's still unfortunate. But here, for example, I readily concede first-time buyers of homes that, according to the official numbers from the National Association of Realtors, 32% of all buyers are first-time buyers, up from 26% a year ago. So it's a little better, but the norm is 40%. And so the first-time buyer thing, which of course is what young people do, if the norm is 40% and it's 32%. And this gets back to what has actually happened to interest rates. Interest rates are an interesting two-edged sword. The Fed aggressively raised the short-term rates. Mortgage interest rates responded aggressively, making it much harder to afford a mortgage on a home, while home prices were rising a bit. But really, the most dramatic thing was the jump in mortgage interest rates, which are indeed making it harder for people to be first-time buyers. But then the two-edged sword of higher interest rates is that all people like me who want to park some of their money in bank CDs are suddenly getting 5% on their money. Interestingly, you know, one of the real reasons why there were no problems with poverty in the early aughts was because the old people were parking their money in CDs and they weren't keeping up with inflation. And so the higher interest rates are penalizing the young and helping the older people who have some money accumulated who want to put their money in those bank CDs, by the way, that Jeff Dice was rhapsodizing about. And I guess I want to do the, I only want to say, with respect to the stock market, you and I discussed it over lunch recently. All I've ever said about the stock market, with which Jeff should agree with, is that when it comes to 15 to 20 year time horizons, the government did something useful for people. In the late 70s, it brought out retirement accounts so that you could park your money and reinvest dividends over many years and use that as a nest egg for your retirement. And by the way, it's been shown that if we could only use our Social Security money for that, we could have done much better. So all I've ever said, echoing other insights that other people have mentioned, is that if you take an index fund, you don't have to be too smart. Take an index fund. How smart is that? At any month since 1970, you don't have to know anything about timing. And take out your money any month over a 15-year period since 1970, January 1970 to January 1985, February 1970 to February 1985, over any 15-year period, you would have been ahead of consumer price index inflation. Over a 20-year period, you would have been substantially ahead. And so when Jeff was rhapsodizing over the days when people could put their money in bank CDs, he was forgetting that, at least in retrospect, up until the present. I'll go with it. Even if, just say, what about the timing? You take out your money in 08, 09 crash. Well, over any 15 years before, if you'd been putting your money in, you still would have been out of inflation. And then, of course, if you retire, you take out the money slowly so you don't take it out every year. No. But with that said, I'm not making a prediction about the future, about the stock market. I only wanted to make the point that Jeff was saying that I'm rather cavalier about the stock market. And all I would say is that I was only talking about long-term investment. If you have a 10-year time horizon, then most of the time you beat inflation with reinvested dividends, but sometimes you don't. But you don't have to be brilliant. An index fund, reinvested dividends, and over any 15, 20, and a 30-year period, over 30-year periods, your median return is 6 to 7% ahead of inflation. Now, where we are headed for the future is another question. I think that the stock market will still outperform inflation, but probably only marginally. That's my best prediction. I see problems ahead. I see accumulated debt. I see the problems with future inflation, but I can mention some other measures, but I think I'm running out of time. I only want to point out that the only argument I've ever made about the stock market is that one, and it has a lot of meaning for tens of millions of people who, let's say at the age of 40, you're earning enough to start saving something. And if you have a 25 to 30-year time horizon, you would have accumulated a decent net debt ahead of inflation over that period. And that's all I would ever claim. But if he's talking about actually gaming the stock market, trying to buy the lows and sell the highs, then I agree with them completely. The average performance of the mutual funds, the average performance of the hedge funds is not nearly as good as simply indexing, simply paying relatively little and just having a machine reinvest your money without any professional management whatsoever. And I acknowledge the exceptions. I think there probably are a few brilliant people who've been able to beat the market handily, but that's not the vast majority of money managers. So Jeff is right about that part of it. It's just that the stock market does unusually well over any 15 to 20 to 25-year period. Have we run out of time, Tom?
Unfortunately so, Gene, but I want to conclude with this. We started, you mentioned that you get the newsletter, the physical newsletter in the mail, and I just finished the current issue.
Yeah, I'm rushing out to my mailbox.
Well, it hasn't been mailed yet, but I sent it over to the printer. But the thing I want you to know, I want folks to know, is that Gene takes advantage of every benefit he gets as a supporting listener, because he's also in our private group. It's not on Facebook, thank goodness. So therefore, we can actually have conversations. Yeah. He's in there. But the other thing is, Gene, as of the night that this episode is released, the very moment, those of you who listen to it the second it comes out, at this very moment, Gene is participating with his wife, Hisako, in one of my murder mystery dinner parties, this one in New York City. And what I love about it is that according to the storyline, Gene's character is actually Dave Smith's butler. Dave Smith is also going to be at the murder mystery dinner party.
I heard the bad news. First of all, as I told your wife, Jenna, I'm not sure that Tom deserves you. I hope he does. You are an incredible woman. She really is just so sweet and charming and smart, but hopefully you do deserve her, Tom. But that is, it wasn't in the script that I had said to Tom, can you humiliate me all the way? I'm going to be Dave Smith's butler.
Well, I think the reason for anybody wondering what's going on here, the reason Gene just mentioned my wife is that it was my wife broke this news to her, to him on the phone the other day. Because she called, you and Hisako called her just for a little bit of a briefing as to what to expect at this party. But it really is self-explanatory. We have great time. I get the penthouse suite at some fancy hotel. We get a catered dinner, and then the murder mystery unfolds. Everybody's in costume. It's a ton of fun. And if you're a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show, you don't even pay for it. Yeah. I mean, you can pay for it if you don't want to be a member, but if you're a member of the supporting listeners program, you can come to these parties and cost you nothing. Free dinner, wonderful evening.
I reread the description of my character. It does appear and I'm not exactly the nicest butler. I'm not that loyal to Dave.
So
that,
no. You guys have a strained relationship.
Yes.
Apparently.
And that aside, as well, and my wife was a little intimidated by the whole, but Janda said, I'm not playing the game. I'll be there to coach you at every stage. And that was really sweet of her because my wife was a little bit intimidated. I still don't know what to expect. If I got the chance to talk to somebody who's actually been up, because Jenna has been through it, I'm looking forward to it, Tom.
Oh, it'll be fun. And of course, Gene, if anything happens to Dave's character, everybody will suspect you because of the old Butler did it storyline.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed.
So anyway, supportinglisteners.com, but most importantly, thesohoforum.org. Find out about their future debates. It may not be clear to you when you're looking at the homepage, but all the debates also have a live stream option. Just click through as if you're ordering tickets for in person, and you will be brought to a free live stream option.
We should do better with that one. We have to keep explaining it.
Gene, I had somebody write to me and say, if only the Soho Forum had a live stream option. I wrote back, not only does it have a live stream option, the live stream is free.
Yeah, we're terrible amateurs. There's you, and then our next debate is actually Glenn Greenwald wrote versus Alan Dershowitz. And that I do urge people, if you want to catch that, to buy their tickets right away. With that one, we're having uptown at Symphony Space Theater because those two guys are super celebrities.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be crazy. I wish I could be there.
Even more famous than you, Tom.
And How about that? All right, I got to let you go, Gene, but thanks so much. TheSohoForum.org, everybody. Thanks to Gene Epstein and to you, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, tell me, and I don't sign off yet. Do I sign off? What do I do, Tom? Well, I don't want to screw up.
Gene, I was trying to end the episode. You have to not talk until I'm done doing that.
Okay, I'm shutting up.
Yeah. All right, so let's try it again. You ready? We're going to keep this in just so everybody sees what I have to deal with on the Tom Woods Show. All right, so long, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, now you pause for a second, Gene, and then we'll talk.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. Here we go. All right, now we're out.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.